And I want to something completely different. If you've ever been in an earthquake, and a lot of people have, you know how suddenly they strike. One second you're on firm ground, and the next your dishes are rattling, or worse. And there's absolutely no warning. But what if people in earthquake-prone areas like Southern California or Japan could get a warning? Would that help? And how much of a warning would you need in order to maybe take cover or hold down something that might fall over? My next guest is developing an earthquake alarm system. Depending on where a quake is centered, people could get a warning anywhere from a few seconds on up. And he reports on this earthquake early warning system this month in the journal Science, and he joins us today to talk about it. Richard Allen is an assistant professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He joins us from WHA in Madison. Welcome to the program, Dr. Allen.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Are you talking about knowing hours in advance when an earthquake might come, or just seconds in advance?
No, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do this hours in advance. We can certainly only do it seconds in advance. And the reason for that is the way that this approach works is we actually detect the nucleation of the earthquake. So the earthquake has actually already started, but we're trying to detect that nucleation very rapidly so that we can get some kind of warning out before the ground motion at the surface actually starts. Of course, when we talk about earthquakes, we're thinking in terms of the ground motion that we feel at the surface. Well, the actual earthquake started a few seconds prior to that. So by detecting that energy and coming up with a warning before the ground starts to shake, we can actually hopefully give some useful information to people so they can prepare themselves.
How fast does that motion move?
Well, there are two types of energy, or two types of wave, rather, which transmit energy associated with earthquakes through the Earth. They're P waves and S waves. And for sort of roughly speaking, P waves travel at about 6 kilometers per second, and S waves travel at about half that speed, about 3 kilometers per second. So they're moving really fast, which is why when there's an earthquake somewhere in Southern California, the whole of Southern California has essentially experienced that earthquake, felt the ground motion within the matter of a minute or two.
So you're saying that you might be able to put sensors all over a certain area, let's say California, and detect it way underground before it reaches the surface and then give us a few seconds warning?
Right. Well, in Southern California, there's already a very dense network across the whole region called TriNet. And TriNet consists of actually several hundred stations across the region. So the network is actually already in place to be able to take this kind of approach to earthquake early warning. And the way that the system works is that when the earthquake actually nucleates deep in the ground, the energy is transmitted by these two waves. Mm-hmm. And so this P wave gets up to the surface first. And we detect that P wave energy and we assess the hazard associated with this earthquake from that P wave energy, which arrives before the more dangerous, the more significant ground shaking associated with the S wave reaches the surface. So we're detecting the first information that we can possibly gather at the surface in order to make this prediction.
And so how much time do you think you could give? Just a few seconds? Is that enough time for people to take any real qualitative action?
Well, the warning time varies. If you're actually at the epicenter, which means you're directly above the location of the earthquake on the surface of the Earth, then we're talking about 0, 1, maybe 2 seconds of warning at the most. However, as you get further away from the epicenter, the warning time increases to a few tens of seconds. And so to give an example, the last sort of major destructive earthquake in Southern California was the Northridge earthquake. Mm-hmm. And in that earthquake, there were buildings that were red tagged, which means that they were severely structurally damaged, so they had to be pulled down after the event out to about 60 kilometers away from the epicenter. And at that kind of distance, you would get about 20 seconds worth of warning given a repeat event. So that's to give you some kind of idea of the range of warning times that you might have. The other half of your question was, well, what can you do with that kind of warning time? Well, there's sort of a whole range of different things that you can do, ranging from sort of personal preservation to more sort of organized and sort of industrial applications to the potential for development of infrastructure in the future which will be able to use this early warning system to be able to protect us from the effects of the ground shaking. Mm-hmm. So to give you some examples in terms of personal preservation, one of the most important things to do when there is an earthquake is to get underneath a desk. In California, they have a duck cover hold sort of strategy where if you feel any ground motion, you should get under a desk and you should hold on to the legs so that the desk remains above you. And that's important because although the buildings may well survive the earthquake, often things like ceiling tiles, lighting fixtures and things like that can fall down, bookcases, and cause serious injury or even death in some cases. So getting under a desk is very important, and you can do that in a fraction of a second. Mm-hmm. However, we have to be a little careful for this kind of earthquake early warning system. For the really big, significant events, we're talking about something which only occurs every few decades. And so it's perhaps unreasonable to expect individuals to react to some kind of warning that comes around so infrequently. So the other kind of uses we can use is when we connect the warning system into some kind of computerized control system. Things like transportation systems, for example, slowing and stopping trains. With the freeways, turning all the lights on the on-ramps of freeways to red would actually stop a significant number of cars without causing any accidents. In terms of utility companies, shutting down power lines for a few seconds can actually cause much wider damage. In the Northridge earthquake, again, high voltage power lines were not actually damaged, but they swung during the ground motion and the wires would touch, shorting out the whole system, causing serious blackout problems. But perhaps the most exciting aspect of an early warning system is the potential for future development. Once we have an early warning system in place and we know the kind of information that we can provide and the amount of warning time that's available, then we can start to build an infrastructure around ourselves which is able to respond to this kind of warning system. An example of that would be what they're currently doing in Japan, where they're building buildings with active response systems. These are buildings that can change their mechanical properties to become stronger or more flexible, given a fraction of a second's warning. So if we have that kind of infrastructure and we have a warning system, then the building around us can actually be ready to protect us from the earthquake. And I think that's the most valuable use.
Talking with Richard Allen on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. About a possible early warning system that might work. As long as I have you here talking about earthquakes, perhaps you could give us an idea of why. We've seen so many earthquakes happen recently. Eastern Turkey May 1st, Algeria May 21st, Japan May 26th. Is a swarm like this common around the world?
I'm not sure that I would say it's common, but I don't think we should read too much into it. I don't think this is the beginning of the end of the world, for example. There's no question that obviously earthquakes are going on all the time, and they seem to occur at relatively random points in time. And when you have a sample like that, you're always going to get clusters of events coming around periodically. And I think that's exactly what we've just seen over the course of the last month. Also, of course, these particular earthquakes, in some cases, particularly in the case of Algeria and eastern Turkey, to some extent, there were significant death tolls associated with those earthquakes as well. So they just had a greater impact in the news. But in terms of having clusters of events like this, I don't think it's particularly unusual, no.
Of course, in areas where the buildings are not meant to survive these earthquakes, then you have terrible loss of life.
Right, well, this is... That's right. This is really the problem. In fact, that's an important point to make. Although we've been working on building this earthquake early warning system, there's no question that the best way to reduce the hazard associated with earthquakes is to be building buildings that can better withstand the ground shaking that comes with these earthquakes. And it's because we don't have these kind of buildings that we see these very high death tolls in Algeria, in Turkey. Also in the 1999 Izmit earthquake in Turkey, there was a very high death toll. In Bhuj, India, there was a high death toll. And sort of in that same period of time, there have been other large earthquakes which haven't had high death tolls, although they've been fairly close to population centers. For example, the Chichi earthquake, it did have a significant death toll, but it was nothing like the Izmit and the Bhuj earthquake, for example. And the reason for that is because of the building standards. In some countries, in the US, for example, in California, in Japan, in Taiwan, the building standards are really very high, and there are very strict building codes in these earthquake-prone regions. And as a result of those building codes, the death toll is significantly reduced.
Dr. Allen, I got to break in because we have to take a break. So stay with us, and we'll take lots more phone questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about earthquakes with my guest, Dr. Richard Allen, Assistant Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Dr. Allen, is there any system in place now, a test system someplace in Southern California there?
Well, our study was all based on using historical data, i.e. earthquakes that have already occurred, and we can test the algorithms using them. Right now, we're in the process, or I should say the people who operate TriNet at Caltech are in the process of implementing some of these algorithms in order to try to really test this system in real time. That's obviously a very important test that needs to be done. And so in that sense, yes, it's in progress. However, we're still in the implementation stage of that process.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Dave in New Jersey.
Hi, I actually live in Seattle, and in the Seattle earthquake we had recently, because of the time of day, a lot of places were videotaped, and I noticed they were really break down into three groups. There were hiders, freezers, and runners, and the hiders seemed not to need much warning. They were under desks instantly, and people who froze, maybe they could benefit, but people like me, unfortunately, if I get a warning that there's an earthquake, I'm going to run, and I just won't be able to help myself. And I wonder if there's any thinking that, you know, maybe an earthquake is better for buildings than for people, better for systems that the scientists there described, rather than to tell people essentially like me to run for the hills.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very good point. I mean, as I said, I think the most important aspect of this is the future development of infrastructure that can use these kind of systems and the control aspects of it. In terms of dealing with individual sort of gut reaction to run for the hills, which is what you're describing, that's an issue. To some extent, that can be dealt with an educational program. But I agree completely with the caller that this is something we should worry about. I have to say, though, that I think to a large extent, these issues are not as severe as people tend to play out. There's currently an earthquake early warning system in operation in Mexico City. It's been in operation for over 10 years now. And one of the concerns there was the effect of false alarms. However, in the 1995 earthquake, it was a fairly large, greater than a magnitude 7 earthquake, which shook the city. An alarm was successfully issued across the city. In fact, there wasn't much damage associated with the earthquake. But the point is that there was an alarm and people did react. And there wasn't a significant negative impact of having that kind of warning. So I think that it's true we do have to be very cautious about the way in which we issue these kind of warnings, and I certainly don't think that the first thing we should be doing when we have an operational system is sort of ringing a bell across Los Angeles. I think that that would be a cause for chaos. But I do think that people are able to be trained to respond to these kind of things, and you can tell people, well, you know, you really want to just get under the desk. It's the safest thing for you to do. And any other concern, of course, you have anyway, when people feel ground motion, people in California know that it is much safer to get underneath the desk when you feel an earthquake, not to start running out of the door and running out of the building. You're far more likely to either injure yourself or be caught in falling debris if you start running around than if you get under your desk.
Okay, Dave, thanks for calling.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Cindy in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I have my own personal theory on the recent earthquakes, and I'm not a seismologist, but maybe your expert there can see if anybody's thought of this. After we went to war in Afghanistan and let off some pretty deep bombs into the earth, there was a series of earthquakes there. Now, I understand they have earthquakes there, but they were pretty much in sequence. Now that we've been in Iraq and have let off even some bigger bombs, what I'm wondering is if this pressure on the earth's crust is putting pressure on all these fault lines. And if that could be the cause of something tremoring in the earth, which in turn just goes around.
Something's just waiting on the edge, and this just
pushes
it over the edge.
Well, all that pressure on the earth's crust can't be good.
Richard Allen, what do you say to that?
Right. Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, first of all, I think that most seismologists would agree that in regions where we do have these earthquakes, the state of the crust is sort of it's ready to slip at any time. And in fact, in these regions where we have these very large earthquakes, there are much smaller magnitude earthquakes which are going on all the time, and that's due to the tectonic forces on the edges of these plates. And so, the difference between a small earthquake and a large earthquake, well, seismologists debate mitigate this to a great extent. But I think many people would agree that the difference between small and large earthquakes is just the size to which a particular earthquake rupture grows. And therein lies the problem in determining whether an earthquake is going to be a large or a small magnitude event. Because if you just have a small rupture, it could then stop and it will be a small magnitude event. Whereas if the rupture continues to propagate for a whole range through a whole range of precarious circumstances, you could say, then you would have a large magnitude earthquake. And that's when people start to worry about or consider the impact of exploding bombs and things like that. For example, when we put dams into particular regions and we fill them up with water, we can significantly increase the pressure on the rock beneath, and this can cause small earthquakes. And so I think what you're talking about is a similar kind of approach. However, having said that, I would be very wary of making the connection that you just made without being looking very carefully at the frequency of earthquakes in the particular region in Afghanistan prior to the detonation of any bombs and after it. And I suspect that it's actually very difficult to really see any correlation between those two.
What about?
But I haven't done it.
What about New Madrid? Are they overdue for?
New Madrid is a real issue with earthquake hazard, and that's essentially because the New Madrid region suffered these very large earthquakes a significant time ago, and so it's very difficult to assess the probability of having a future event. If you go to a plate boundary, such as along the west coast of the United States, then you continually have these plates moving next to one another, and we can get a sense for what the rate of that motion is, and that's what allows us to come up with what I think are fairly good probabilistic hazard assessments. When you get to New Madrid, it's much more difficult. And in fact, seismologists are currently debating whether if you look at a hazard map for the United States, you find bullseyes in New Madrid. And seismologists are currently debating what the level of that bullseye should be.
How seriously are people taking your study and your conclusion that you can, you know, set up these early warning systems? It seems like it would be an expensive thing to do to have to, you know, put all these monitors in the ground. Unless, as you say, there are places where they have all of these in Southern California.
Right. That's actually, I mean, the point of this particular study is that the only infrastructure, the only hardware, the seismometers that we used are seismometers that are already in place. So this early warning system is about adding to the current efforts that this particular network, TriNet, is currently going through. And so in that sense, there isn't a significant cost associated with putting seismometers out. And that's an important difference between this particular study and the studies, the proposed earthquake early warning systems in the past. All the seismometers are essentially in place. So what do we need to do between the where we are now and actually having a system is, well, first of all, we need to actually implement these algorithms on the real-time system. And that is a technical challenge, there's no question about it, but it's a question of implementing the algorithms. Beyond that, we actually have to think about how we're going to issue the warning. That's one component that we haven't really talked about at all or thought about at all, is how we actually get this warning from our central processing site out to the people who want to hear the warning. And obviously that will require some kind of infrastructure and some kind of cost. But I guess I would argue that, you know, given the cost of these earthquakes, even though we do not expect very high death tolls in significant events in California due to the quality of the buildings, the actual cost of these earthquakes is significant. And maybe we can start to reduce some of these costs by issuing a warning so people can move infrastructure into a kind of safe mode. And so I would argue that, you know, any money spent on this, well, not any money, but money spent on this is well spent. Over the course of the next few decades.
So you were mentioning before that one of the big hazards is the power lines not coming back, but them swaying and hitting each other.
Right.
And so it would be in the power company's big interest to try to implement something like this. Even if it is a false alarm, they have nothing to lose except for a few seconds of missed power. Right.
Well, right. But the example you chose, that's actually quite a significant cost to a false alarm. If a power company switches off power lines and that could entail power outages for significant regions, then there obviously is a significant impact. And so they would not want to do that if there was a risk that this was a false alarm. However, other kind of activities that you can do don't actually have significant costs associated with them. And so these false alarms, you can actually just think as being a drill. And if there isn't a significant cost, then it's not too too important. But that brings us to an important issue that we haven't talked about yet, and that's false alarms. False alarms are essentially when the system triggers and issues a warning and there isn't really significant ground motion. And that's something that we haven't done a significant study on yet, and so we need to do that in the future. And that's actually what we plan on doing once we have our system implemented and running in real time in Southern California. We can both be testing for the problems of false alarms associated with noise spikes in the earth, and also with the system itself, the way the system operates and interacts with its different components has the potential to cause false alarms. But having said that, let me just also say that when we designed this system, we designed it to be able to deal with this. The whole system is built on the idea that you gather information from these seismometers across Southern California in real time. And so as time goes on, there's more information available, and so we can be more and more certain about the conclusions we're drawing about the hazard associated with the earthquake. So if the false alarm problem turns out to be more of an issue than we thought, well, that just means we have to wait an extra 2 or 3 seconds before we issue the warning than we are anticipating. So we will still be able to issue a useful warning, it's just it will be 1 or 2 seconds later than we might anticipate right now.
All right. Well, I have to issue a warning that we're coming up on a break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Very short break, talking with Richard Allen, Assistant Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Ed in Canton, Ohio. Lots of folks from Ohio today. Hi, Ed.
Hi. One of the cheaper ways of doing this would be to send out some sort of a warning to people in the area. For instance, we had an earthquake off Lake Erie years ago. Now, if we had had my cat or my dog in the area, he would immediately have reacted, because apparently animals do react to earthquakes. And to supplement that, you would see the animal rushing for the bed and know that something's about to happen and get under the desk.
Have you seen your animal do this?
Yes, yeah.
Really?
Every time we have a thunderstorm.
Well, how about an earthquake?
Well, that's what I mean. I've heard and read that animals react to earthquakes too. So,
any evidence of that, Richard?
I think we have to be very cautious about those kind of conclusions. I'm very skeptical about the utility of that kind of approach. A lot of the stories that we hear, or a lot of the evidence for animals reacting to earthquakes, is sort of anecdotal. And it's often relays to when there's been an earthquake, it's after the fact information, which is something we have to be very wary about. After there's been an earthquake, somebody will say, oh, you know, my dog was acting very strangely earlier this afternoon. I think it must have known the earthquake that's coming. And as scientists, we have to be very cautious about that kind of evidence, because there's obviously a bias associated with it. So personally, I think we need to be very wary about taking that approach, and I certainly wouldn't be recommending taking that approach to a sort of official implemented earthquake early warning system, which is going to impact a lot of people, which is what we're proposing at the moment.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, people seeing water rising in wells.
Right.
And the rocks that glow piezoelectrically from being
That's right.
Compressed.
Actually, the piezoelectric one is one which has had a lot more study associated with it, but again, without really any really strong conclusions. I don't think there are many people who would argue that we should be building an earthquake warning system based on those kind of approaches right now. Some of those studies are still continuing, so that may change in the future. But the water issue as well, people have seen changes in springs and things like that, for example. And most of these are actually associated with strain, with the fact that these tectonic plates may be sliding past one another without causing an earthquake. And then there may be an earthquake follows that event. Again, though, I don't think we should overplay these things. I think that certainly the vast majority of seismologists would tell you that we do not see predicting earthquakes, i.e. Having an assessment of when an earthquake is going to occur before it's actually occurred in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And it's given that we as seismologists really have a responsibility to think about other ways that we can go about mitigating the effects of earthquake hazard. And that's partly what this earthquake early warning system is all about.
Dr. Allen, I want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Great, my pleasure.
Richard Allen, Assistant Professor of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, talking about earthquakes. Earlier, we spoke with Lynn Kaminsky of the American Astronomical Society and the Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Thaw Moorman in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music. And we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. If you want to write us, send us letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday on our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also go there and listen to back editions of Science Friday and download them on your Real Audio player. And also you can look at Science Friday's Kids Connection, which makes free curriculum from all of Science Friday's programs. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.